difficult and somewhat complex subject matter, which we began a month ago when I was here last. And I'd like to continue with that theme and develop a little bit further. You may recall that the primary topic that we discussed last month was one line, or two lines actually, which the Talmud has for us from the Sefer Brachos and the Chof Daled Amud Aleph, where the Gemara begins by telling us that Tefach B'Isha Erva, and discusses the ins and outs, the details of that, and the next line is called Shok B'Isha Erva. We spoke at some length about those two lines, about the idea of objective and subjective, and I proposed an interesting theory which drew some interesting criticism, which I guess all theories which are not accepted by everybody provoke, which is fine. And I want to emphasize once again, as I did last time, that I'm not coming here to Paskin Shilas. You are very fortunate to have a distinguished Rav Marad Asriuk and Paskin Shilas for you. I'm here just to explain some of the background information which will be interesting to you, and to give you some of the basis of what the rabbis actually passed the shalos based upon. And the theory which we propounded last time basically was that the issue of erva with respect to the married woman and the single woman, we were discussing primarily the common ervas, that was what the majority of the shiur was about last time, is subjective. It depends upon the time and the place. We had questions concerning the Mishnah Brura's statement, which is accepted by many, that there are certain objective ervas which never change, what he called the Zeroah and the Shok. His interpretation of the Shok as being the upper thigh as opposed to the calf, the lower part of the leg, was also questionable. Again, this question, none of them are my own. We were just quoting from earlier sources, Chazanish and other Gedolim. And one of the ways that was assumed, that the expression Das Yehudis, which the Mishnah Berurah quotes in Siman Ayin Hey, based on the Gemara and Ksubis, discussing Zerol Seh Magulos, is nothing more than the Rashi explained it to be, which is the Minig of Benos Yisrael of Tznius. And it's the Minig of Benos Yisrael of Tznius that could change. What's called Das Yehudis in a particular time and place could be not Das Yehudis in a different place. And this could go up and down as the case may be. The halachic hemline can move depending on the particular societal mores. And as my kiddush was, that there's no need to paint over the wedding pictures from 30 years ago, because even though today it would be unacceptable, but 30 years ago maybe it was acceptable. Obviously, the burgeoning industry in painting over the pictures wouldn't do too well if they listened to me. But they don't, so it's no problem. They're flourishing, and I'm just telling you what I think. That was the major point of last month's Shia. The end of the Shia, we started talking about another third line in the Sukkah, which is also very, very complex. Seyar B'Isha Erev. Now you know that in contradistinction to the first two, Seyar B'Isha Erev, as we understand it, applies to married women only. Sure. Oh, of course. Seyar means hair. The hair of the woman is considered erva. Erva means something which is supposed to be covered. And if it's not covered, one may not recite the Shema when in view of that particular object that we're discussing. If we have a chance, we'll go into what that means in detail either this time or next. As I said before, we assume it's applied only to the hair of a married woman. When I say we assume, I mean we assume nowadays. Nowadays, in our time and in our place. If you look at the Rambam, Maimonides, and if you take his expression literally, in the simplest form, he seems to make no distinction whatsoever between single or married women in this regard. The Rambam seems to say, in his Mishnah Torah, that Lo Telachna Benos Yisrael Pruos Rosh Peshuk, that the daughters of Israel should not go with their hair uncovered in the marketplace. And his expression then is, achas pnios v'achas eish esish, whether they are single or whether they are married. So writes the Rambam. The Rambam is a pretty authoritative source. We don't just, they say in Mishmachavek, we don't just make light of the opinion of the Rambam. Yet to my knowledge, it's almost nowhere in the world today, Tavshin Nun Beis, where this is followed. I say the word today advisedly. 50 years ago, we couldn't make that statement. Because 50 years ago, there was still a Jewish community intact in Yemen. And in Yemen, they were still following the customs of the Rambam. And if you will do some of your historical research, you will find that in the observant community in Yemen, young ladies, before they were married, covered their hair. After all, Rambam. They followed the Rambam to the letter. Nowadays, I don't know of any community where this is followed whatsoever. I don't know of any. Lorena and Arai, maybe there is a community somewhere. I don't know of any offhand. Of course, the question becomes, how can that change? Now, there are those who reinterpret the Rambam. He never meant that a single girl has to cover her hair, but he said it. Well, it only means a single girl who's now single, but she was married, or something else happened, or some kind of story. But not the straightforward reading of the Rambam referring to the average woman who never was married, who was a basula, who has no history whatsoever. They try to reinterpret the Rambam. And one of the sources for the reinterpreting Rambam is a Mishnah, a famous Mishnah, which many of you may know, which tells us in the Ksubas, at the beginning of the second parak, how do we know if a woman, when she was married, was she a virgin, was she a basula? And this is monetary ramifications as to how much a Ksuba is supposed to be. And the Mishnah tells us if she was Yotza Behinuma of Arosha Parua, if she went to the chuppah with some kind of a veil, but her hair was uncovered, basically, then we are guaranteed that she is a basula and she has a higher amount of money coming to her. This seems to imply that before the wedding, there is no obligation upon her to cover the hair. Of course, the question was, Rambam knew about that Mishnah too. Rambam quotes that Mishnah. So how can the Rambam be so oblivious to that Mishnah when he makes this pronouncement that even a single woman has to cover her hair? So the answer presumably is given by later Achronim in a different context. You know that marriage has two parts. It's Erusin and it's Nisuin. You may not know because today we do it all together in a blur. The time of the Talmud was separated by approximately a year, as the Mishnah Ksubas tells us. The Erusin is he puts a ring on her finger. So now they are betrothed to one another. And she is now under pain of punishment, of capital punishment, if she's guilty of adultery, because she's now married to him. Yet they're living apart. She's living with her parents, he's living with his parents, and she's preparing the marital home. It took a long time. They had to, you know, check up the latest fashions and home interior decorating, and it took a year to do it. So they would get married after approximately, they would move into the marital home together, what we call marriage, nisuin. Now there's a big controversy whether a woman who was arusa, who was betrothed but not fully married, does she have to cover her hair? So once again, there's a very powerful force in the law, which is of course not, and the proof is the same Mishnah. The Mishnah says that when she went to the nisuin, to the chuppah, with the hair uncovered, this indicates that she was never married before. But if she had an obligation to cover her hair from the moment of Erusin a year ago, how could she go to the wedding without her hair covered? That's quite a problem. So the way out is a remarkable way out. Yes, she covered her hair for the year. For a whole year her hair was covered. But then she took it off for that one night. She took off the sheitel or the head covering for that night so she could demonstrate that she was married for the first time and she was in fact a basula, a virgin. And then she put it back on again. So it was on again, off again, on again. This is how the commentaries who maintain that a betrothed woman is required to cover her hair defend their position, which seems to be against the Mishnah. Well, we can understand ourselves that same defense would work for the Rambam. The Rambam maintains that every woman, even before she's betrothed, has to cover her hair. So how do you get out of the Mishnah? The same way. You have to cover your hair, you take it off for the night of the wedding, you put it back on the next day. So that same defense would apply. Of course, I noticed from your expression, many people find this defense hard to believe. How can that be? It's impossible. So this leads them to various conclusions. Namely, that it's unheard of that a single woman should have to cover her hair, which is of course minhag Ashkenaz. We've never heard of such a thing, as far as I know, in Ashkenaz. And moreover, this leads many to the conclusion that even a betrothed woman need not cover her hair. The way out, the other way to say that the other position is to maintain that yes, there's an obligation to cover the hair, but it's only what we call Das Yehudis. Das Yehudis means that it is a custom of tznius, of modesty, which the Jewish women accepted upon themselves. And as I said before, it can come and go. The Yemenite woman today who lives in Jerusalem and doesn't cover her hair when she's single, she's not in violation of what the Rambam said. Rambam is speaking for his time. If her grandmother 50 years ago in Yemen, when she was a single girl, a teenager, would not cover her hair, she'd be in violation. But the granddaughter living in Jerusalem, with his custom, just never made it, never operation magic carpet that was lost. So just that the custom never made it, she's not in violation. The same way as a woman wearing a particular kind of a dress in one society is in violation, in another society is not in violation. As we said earlier, this is another example of what we call the Das Yehudis. And therefore, one can argue that even if the obligation to cover hair exists either for a single woman or for a married woman who's just betrothed, it could be taken off the night of the wedding, because that became the custom. To demonstrate the fact that there was no previous marriage, they demonstratively removed the head covering, which was not a Torah violation, because the Torah, by Torah law, the obligation didn't come in yet. When did it come in exactly? That's the question. We mentioned last time that we mentioned another theory. There's another one. This is my second pet theory I mentioned to you last month, which I'll review right now, which is a possibility to interpret a reason for the Torah's command. We're assuming for the moment that the Torah command, which is the simple reading of the Gemara in Ksuvot, Gemara goes Lashon Das Moshe, Daraisa. The Torah command for the married woman to cover her hair is so that it should be known in a flash, in a jiffy, in an instant, in a glance, who is single and who is married. And therefore we explained that the Torah commandment exists only if three conditions are met. One, it's in the street. Otherwise, people would not know who this woman is. Number two, when she's presently married, as opposed to being married in the past. And number three, it could be fulfilled by the covering of the majority of her head, which is enough to be seen by everybody, even though there's more hair extending beyond the covering. In addition, we said that the Torah obligation, assuming that this Rashi seems to say, is that the real Torah obligation is derived from Soto. The adulterous woman who's described in Parshas Naso, where it's read there, we read that Uporayas Rosha Yisha, and he will uncover the head of the woman, and the Gemara in Ksubas explains that apparently until that point it was covered. Because from there we derive that a married woman is required to cover her hair. And I mentioned to you last time that a sota, one woman suspected of adultery and going through the whole rigmarole, the whole ritual in the Beis HaMikdash, must be a woman who's already lived with a husband, otherwise it won't work, because it's Baladei Yisheikh, it's Kodma Shchivas Baal, Shchivas Abol. She has to live with a husband, the marriage has to have been consummated, before that there cannot be any Sota process. So therefore, it would appear to me that the Torah obligation to cover the hair exists only after husband and wife have lived together as man and wife, and therefore before that point, the obligation to cover the hair, if it exists, is purely rabbinic, based upon custom, the Das Yehudis. And it's for this reason that until recently, and when I was growing up, which is not that long ago, all the kalas would come to the chasana with a very sheer veil, you could see right through it, and that's what they would wear straight through the wedding, and no one said boo. Now, in certain circles, it doesn't go that way anymore. How can it be? How can she go with the veil? Once he puts the ring on her finger, she's already married. And once they say Sheva Brahma, she's already in the Suah. And once they go to the Yichud room, the whole marriage is 100% complete. How could she come out with a veil? That's not a proper covering. You can see right through it. So therefore, there are different customs emerge. In some places, they put on the shavuot in the Yichud room. Poor woman has 10 minutes of privacy the whole night, and she's sitting there patching with a wig. So then the next custom was, that's not fair. So they put on the wig already before they go to the wedding. It's against the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that, you know, that indicates something not so whatever. But anyway, but what can you do? There's no choice. That's the way things have happened. And that became the custom, and still the custom in many circles today. And again, once again, if that's the custom in that circle, it has to be followed. If you go to Williamsburg or Borough Park, where these weddings are done in that fashion, then that's the din. And far be it for me to question their practice. It's, for them it's mandatory. Mandatory, because that's how it is in those places. The Das Yehudis became through a variety of circumstances, but now the woman, from the moment she sets a foot into the hall, oh, by definition, she's going to come with a shekel on, because there's no other time to put it on, and that can't say it's obligation to put it on from the time she walks through the hall, but once the ring is on the finger, if that's became the custom in those circles, so that's the way it is. Like a Mishnah, against the Mishnah, these things can change. So if it became more stringent, it became more stringent. But from the strict perspective of the Torah law, it would appear to me that the obligation to cover the hair really begins only in effect the next morning after the husband and wife have been together. So what emerges in many circles is that she wears this veil. This veil is somewhat of a covering which, by Das Yehudis, by the Jewish custom, is a sufficient method to tell us everybody who the Kala is. No. I was very upset. I was at a wedding some years back where the Kala took off a veil. When I say the veil, I mean the part which the hair piece, and I mean the part in front that's taken off right away. But she took it off and she was going with the Rosh HaParuah. So I was very upset. Why was I upset? Not that I could say it's an Issim and a Torah violation, because I just tried to show it to you why it's not. I was upset because I view that to be what we call a piritza. Where the opposite of sneers is priest. A piritza means literally a hole in the fence. Because at all the weddings I'd been up to until that point, at every single wedding I was at, the kala, for the whole wedding, she wore something on her head. Be it big, be it small, be it thick, be it thin. There was some kind of hairpiece on her head. And I'll tell you a secret, even those women who never had any intention of covering the hair later, but still, for the marriage, for the wedding itself, they had something on their head. So look at the pictures. Look at the pictures from 40 years ago when most women in America didn't cover their head. You'll still watch every kala had something on their head, not just at the ceremony, but you'll look straight through, look at the pictures by the bench, and you'll still see she's wearing that thing on her head. And here this girl, 10 years ago, and in a time when things were different already, she's gone around like this, bothered me. Well, that gives you an indication. What's the definition of a piritza? A piritza is you went through a fence. Of course, once the fence is already broken in so many places, it doesn't bother you so much anymore. But I'd never seen it before, it bothered me. Still bothers me. I'm still talking about it 10 years later. So I view that to be what I call a piritza. Someone went through a fence, because it wasn't that way in previous generations and in previous years. I don't think I've seen it since either, for that matter. But it made an impact, an impression on me. So therefore, since it's only a Das Yehudis, so the custom is she wears any veil, even though it's not so thick, it doesn't cover everything. That's the Das Yehudis. I think it exists in what I would loosely call our circles, where they're not so careful to put on the sheitel before the wedding ceremony even begins. And as once as again, according to the law of the Mishnah, the simple reading of the Mishnah, that's the way it's supposed to be. That's the simple reading of the Mishnah. Okay, so this is therefore is the obligation to cover the hair, which, as I said before, according to the simple reading of Rashi, is a Torah obligation on a woman who's actually married in the street, in public, to cover the majority of her head, based upon the source of sota, and any other obligations, be it in a state of widowhood, or in the private abode, or to cover beyond the majority of the head, to cover the entire hair. And then the sefer having brought with me, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Chatzalik of Rav Sefer Igros Moshe, Ibn Ezra Chelik Aleph, where he writes that the woman who's married should cover all of the head except for what he calls a tefach by tefach. That is we discussed it last week already, tefach b'sherba, last month. The size of a fist squared. So Rav Moshe did a little bit of calculation mathematics, and he measured out the forehead of the average person, and he calculated out that the average forehead is about two fists across. So by higher math, Rav Moshe came to the understanding that if it's two fists across, you want to leave hair up in the front, you should leave up the size of what he called a half a fist up. Because two fists by a half a fist equals one by one. Two times a half equals one. And one times one equals one. So there it is. So you're at Rav Moshe's psak, you can keep up a half a tefach up exposed without being considered in violation of any halacha whatsoever. There's a whole literature about this. Hasidim would never accept that. Absolutely not one hair should be visible. And that's one of the reasons, one of them, that in some Hasidic communities to this day, there's no hair to show. I mean, they make sure of it. Right? That they, as soon as she's married, they shave the head. Yes. Very good question. Very good question. I may have mentioned this last time, I don't remember. I'm not against the shaving looking pretty. No, it doesn't bother me. It can look pretty, it can be fashionable, it can be anything you want. What I am against is that it looks like the woman's hair. That bothers me. Again, for the same reason. If the point, as I understand it, of the shetel is that it should be clear that the hair is not a natural hair, so we should know right away that she is married, that you do all kinds of gimmicks, that the human hair shetelach and the natural hair shetelach and the falls and the mices, and I don't even know half these tricks myself, I just hear about it on my phone call that I get childless about. These tricks, that's against the spirit of the law for sure, maybe even against the letter. Maybe. So again, I can't take on the whole industry. I'm starting with a lot of the heavy hitters in the lobbying. I'm not going to get involved with these people. But if you ask me, I wouldn't approve it. I think the woman should wear a shetel, which is very attractive. Nothing wrong with it, should be nice. But it should be clear that it's a shetel. It should be clear that it's a wig. It's not her own hair. That's what I'm in favor of. All right? She wants to wear, she can wear a hat too. Wear a kerchief, anything like that. But these kind of things which look exactly like her hair, I don't like them. Yes? Yeah.
I think the Hungarians, even when they wear a shetel, have to cover their hair.
We mentioned that briefly last time. That's basically Gemara. The Gemara seems to say, so you have to wear two coverings. A shetel plus a hat. Satma, always. Always. Not, I don't know. All Hungarians, but certainly in the Satma community, there's a shetel with a hat, with a cat covering, with a hat on top. And if you look, the Litvaks have a Torah time. They try to defend their custom, which was only to wear a shetel with no hat on top. And they write, and they write, and they write, and they write, all kinds of tulpulim. I know what the answer is, in my opinion, the answer is, it's a minute change. Once again, the custom was originally to wear a wig plus a hat, and now it's to wear a wig. Things can change. In my opinion, as you follow my idea, the Torah law can't change. That's the Torah law has never changed. That's one of the 13 principles of faith. The Torah law has never changed. But the custom of Jewish women can change. Yeah.
On the one hand, we talk about minhagim changing and times changing,
right,
and that being okay. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we talk about it being a problem if somebody, let's say, breaks the fence and goes off and changes something. So I'm just wondering, how do you?
That's a very good question. We discussed a little bit last time. If, in my opinion, the things can change, well, how do they change? I mean, how did it happen? For centuries, all the single women covered their hair in Yemen, whoever it was, and now it just changed. No, they emigrated, things fell in, the headlines go up, they went down. It could be the first 100 people did it were doing an Avera, but afterwards it just sort of caught on. It's the other way around too. How did it come all of a sudden that the headline go down to the ankle and took two? How'd that happen? It's the same question backwards. Well, one Rebbetzin did it, and then the other people, the rabbi liked it, and he made a speech about it, and it was a frum tendency, so it caught on, and now he's stuck with it. Can't have it anymore. That's the change backwards. So these things can change with the times, like other things can change.
I wanted the permission to say that the Shabbos clock, the lights go up automatically at, say, 10 o'clock at night. The ones who did it originally were over by Messiah. Because all of a sudden you pass a man's house, 8 o'clock, the light is on, 10 o'clock is off. But now that everybody knows there's such a thing as a Shabbos clock, you don't suspect.
Mm-hmm.
So see, it changed. In other words, it changed.
But this lady was calling me, so if she does, I do. The change is not because it's a change in style, a change in the dress, a change in the way women make up. It is a change because it is a movement.
Well, sometimes.
Some
depends. Sometimes what happens is it affects the pirtza. I would say if you brought back to this world the Yemenite Rabbanim from 100 years ago, they go, oh, what are you doing to me over here? Now these women, they're single, these 15-year-old girls are going around with no head covering. What's going on, Gefellach? They would come out, they would scream and yell. But the present Yemenite rabbis, they're very happy. This is the custom now that we have in Israel. I'm talking about the frumster. That changed, that's all. Yeah.
In the beginning, when you discussed the beginning of the Perek Sheni, how you can tell if she's a virgin outside the Hinnunah.
Right.
Is that all? Because when we find pasuk to say so, when the husband complains,
that's a different statute. We're discussing whether no complaints. No chalila, no complaints. Everything is on 100% on the up and up. Now, I want to discuss something which is a. It's going to be a. Yeah.
The same thing, the man, Turi Yemenite, they don't wear yarmulkes only when they eat or travel.
That's how things can change. Now they wear yarmulkes. 100 years ago they didn't wear yarmulkes, now they wear yarmulkes. But that's a different issue. That's not an issue of Erevah. That's a different. But you're right, but Hagim can't change. Look at the German Jews. The German Jews, they never wore yarmulkes. They didn't wear yarmulkes, except when they were learning and when they were davening and when they were eating. They went a whole day with Gili Rosh. You won't find that today. Almost, you won't find that. You go into the homes, I know I live near the German community in Washington. They're all yarmulkes now, all the time. I'm talking about at work. Work is a different story. I'm talking about in their house, they're all yarmulkes. To this day. Okay, so that's good. All right. So good. Different customs. But
talking about head covering, there are some very orthodox why you rabbanim
who fly somewhere. Oh, yeah. That's not a fair statement. Let me tell you why it's not fair.
I'm sorry.
Just leave out the word YU and I'll buy it. if it was limited to that yeshiva, I would have to defend it on that basis. But we all know it does nothing. The Aruch HaShulchan lived before YU was born. And the Aruch HaShulchan wrote that the Torah 100 years ago that by the Nesenu Arabim, and he's talking about Lithuania, Litvisha communities, they didn't cover their hair. He wrote that there was none of them covered their hair. What's going on? It's about the Nesenu Arabim. And he has this landmark heter, which Rav Moshe is masking to in the Sefer, which said, wait, let me finish the sentence. that's dangerous. The heter is not that she should not cover the hair. That's not what it says. The heter is that even though Baba Naseinu Harabim, that's the Lashon of the Aruch HaShulchan, due to our great sins, the married women don't cover the hair. But what's permissible is that while the Shulchan Aruch it states that you may not say a bracha or say Kriya Shema when a woman is right in front of you with the hair uncovered, so the Aruch HaShulchan writes, he thinks that nowadays, the vast majority of the women did not cover the hair even if they were married. You may say the Shema or a bracha or a benching, whatever it may be, when the woman is right in front of you without a hair covered. That's all he said. He never gave a dispensation to say that you don't have to cover the hair. Oh, that's not what he said. That's not what Rav Moshe said either. No, that's not what they said. They said it because, unfortunately, due to our great sins, that's how they write, this bad custom became so prevalent, so then you can, in fact, say the brook. Now, here's an interesting twist. Rav Moshe writes in the Sefer that he thinks that the Aruch HaShulchan said this landmark heter only with respect to the hair of the married woman. But he never would have said it if a woman, for example, goes sleeveless. A woman goes without her arms covered. Rav Moshe never would have said it. Never. What's the context of the tshuva? It's a different story. We're not going to go into right now. But the mechitzin shuv. So Rav Moshe is a famous tshuva, which is also very controversial. The Satmar Rebbe went about this tshuva. Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he writes that the purpose of a mechitza is not to prevent the men from looking at the women. No, that's not the purpose of the mechitza. The purpose of the mechitza is only that the men and the women shouldn't talk together during davening. That's the whole purpose of the mechitza. That's the separate. They shouldn't talk. Doesn't matter if they can see or not. It could be made of glass, Rav Moshe writes. And there are some shuls today that the mechitza is made from glass, based on Rav Moshe's tshuvas. That's what he writes. And it's wrong. Oh, not for now. But in that same tshuva, Rav Moshe writes, what's going to be if the married women don't cover their hair, or don't cover it properly, they come with improper head coverings to shul. So Rav Moshe there writes, oh, but there's an Aruch HaShulchan. And the Aruch HaShulchan says that nowadays that so many women don't cover their hair, so therefore this problem is not the problem of the men who want to say Shema to Shul with the mechitzah to which you can see. But he writes, if they come to Shul wearing sleeveless dresses and you can see the sleeves, the arms exposed through the above the mechitzah, then it's no good. Then he says, the Aruch HaShulchan's dispensation wouldn't apply to us. Look, forget about it. That's what he says. And just to be a little bit naughty, I wanted to say exactly the reverse. The reverse, opposite. Why? Last week we spoke a little bit about the idea of the sleeves, with the hemline, and we explained, that at least according to the opinion of many, We quoted, if you recall, last year, on the bottom of the Rosh, in Masech de Brochas, in that same Daf, Daf Chav Dalet, a machlokas of two classical commentaries, the Divrei Chamudas and the Teferes Shmuel. One of them said that it's an objective Erev, like the Mishnah Berurah said, and even if all of them go that way, it doesn't make a difference, it's still Shok Tevach Misha Erev, it's terrible. Other one said, no. It's a custom that they all go that way, and it's, what's the big deal? The whole purpose is because of what he called hirur, because of arousal. And if it's become so commonplace, this consideration ceases to exist. And the expression is the Divrei Chamudas, Mistabe de Chamakal Mamakal Lefim and Hago, the Midu who time by Elad Zidvar Mishirigila Shalola Chasosam Lo Mikri Erva, Shudlas the Buhuda de Hiru, came in the Ragabu, Kidl Kamal, Gabi Kol Vaseya. So it's a controversy. So I thought that there are many opinions who maintain that even if all the women were sleeveless, let's say in a certain community, even though it used to be, it still is in most communities, a violation of Das Yehudis is a terrible thing, it's a pirza. But if in some other communities it becomes very commonplace, then perhaps it would not be a violation of this part. It wouldn't be a violation on the woman's part, perhaps. And even if it's a violation on her part, it wouldn't be a violation on the man's part if he's saying the Shema when this is exposed because he's used to it. When it comes to the hair, I want to be contrary. I want to come up with a chumrah. A chumrah I want to come up with. Why? The Chazon Ish asks the following kasha. Chazon Ish asks, wait a minute. There's a woman, and she's not covering her hair. I have no idea she's single or married. I have no idea whatsoever. I don't know. I never met her before. So I'm sitting there minding my business. I want to make a bracha. I'm in the library somewhere. I don't know where I'm at. And there's this woman opposite me. She's not covering her hair. I have no idea if she's single or married. What's it do? I never met her. I don't know who she is. Can I make a bracha or not? So he says, he thinks that even though I don't know who she is, so he'll say, how can I be an Arab? Maybe she's single for all I know. Nevertheless, you should not make the bracha. Why? Maybe she's married. Ah, but the question becomes, but the whole point is, it's only an Arab if she's in fact married, and you don't know she's married. So the answer he says is as follows. I'm going to paraphrase. He didn't say it exactly the same way. The fundamental difference between Seir Be'isha Erva and all the other Ervas, Tefach, Shok, that we discussed last time, all the others, there's an obligation upon the woman to cover it. You know why? Because it leads the man to arousal. Why must the woman cover this part of body, part A, and not part B? Because, given the circumstances, part A, if the man sees, is going to be cause your hurim, evil thoughts, and part B will not cause evil thoughts. So therefore the obligation exists because it's an erva, therefore it's an obligation upon the woman to cover. That's all other cases. That applies to single and married equally. There's no difference between single and married women. When it comes to the hair, it's exactly the opposite in my opinion. First came the obligation to cover the hair, a halakhic obligation. And once the halakhic obligation exists to cover the hair, then the rabbis call it an erev. Exactly the opposite. One second. Huh? Oh, slow. So the Gemara quotes a pasuk. The pasuk is from Shir HaShirim. The Shir HaShirim sounds like Sarech Ke'eder or Izim. The pasuk over here, which is quoted in Brachas, Daf Chav Dalet. And this is what leads to Rambam. And those who are in his camp to say, applies to single women too. If Sarah Keder or Ezin. So what's the difference? What? The 16-year-old girl, her hair is less pretty than the 70-year-old woman whose hair is no longer as pretty as the 16-year-old woman. So how come the 16-year-old woman need not cover and the 70-year-old need cover? What's the harm here? So the Rambam said they all have to cover. But if you hold against the Rambam, what's the pshat? That's the pshat. The halacha is that the married woman has an obligation to cover here, which is derived from sota, which the Gemara Ksuba derives from Afayim Beit, which the Gemara Ksuba says in the Raisa. Then the rabbis came along and said, since the woman has an obligation to cover her hair, therefore, as a result of that obligation to cover it, it has a status of erva. And if the woman is single, and as such has no obligation to cover her hair, there is no status of erva. So it works backwards. Or the cases of Erev, it's the other way around. You have to cover the hair because it's intrinsically an erva. It's an erva even if you don't have an obligation. I'll give you a perfect example. A goy, a shiksa, a non-Jewish woman. What's the law? She has no obligations. She's not obligated to cover anything. She has no obligations, she doesn't. I mean, they go, let them go. Today's world, the non-Jewish women go, no obligation on her. She's not doing anything wrong by her religion. Are you allowed to say the Shema when it's a woman is in a bikini or something or whatever and right in front of you? No. No, because this kind of a site should not be held by the Jewish man at any time, as we discussed. And certainly not when he's trying to concentrate on his Krishna. Well, she's not Jewish, that's okay. Well, what kind of statement is that? That's ridiculous. That's crazy. We all know that that's wrong. Because it's intrinsic. That those parts of the body that are being exposed are intrinsically arousing, and therefore there's no license to read the Shema when they're in front of you, to look at it in general terms. And if you're a Jewish woman, you have to cover it, because you don't want a man looking at you that way. So first came the intrinsic erva status, then came the obligation of the Jewish woman to cover it. But when it comes to the hair, it's backwards. When it comes to the hair, there's no intrinsic obligation to cover the hair. Proof, single women don't have to do it. First came the obligation to cover it. As a result of that, the rabbis considered it erva. I'll bring you proof. The other post of a shayla, what's it then by the hair of a non-Jewish woman? Do we say Sarah b'isha erva by the hair of a non-Jewish woman? Halacha l'maase, you have a cleaning lady in your house. She comes, you tell her to dress modestly. She dresses with sleeves down to the wrists and with a long, whatever she wears, pants, or she wears a long skirt. Fine. And she's doing the laundry, or she's mopping the floor. And you want a bench in the house, but she's a married woman. Tokvish can shake her. She's not married now, not covering her hair. May you bench her, may not. They say bracha now. What's it doing? So the post of a shayla, what do we say? The law of Seir b'Sheva by a goy or not? Comes Rav Moshe in a tshuva, the more recent volume, and says he thinks that this whole shayla, I think it's the chayodim of the shayla, this whole shayla only applies in circles and countries where the non-Jewish women, when they marry, cover their hair. It's a Gemara. The Gemara Beferish in Sanhedrin talks about that if there's this concept of marriage by a Jew, by non-Jews too. From when are they considered unmarried? When she uncovers her hair. That means if you look in the history books, you don't need to know the Gemara for this. The history books, the non-Jewish women they married also cover their hair. And they don't need a get. The way they demonstrate that they're no longer married, they uncover their head. So Rav Moshe writes, that's the Shana Chayada. In a society where the non-Jewish woman, when she's married, covers her hair, doesn't have a status of erva, because by societal norms, or even their Goyish religion, or whatever reason, they would cover their hair when they were married, so that makes it have a status of erva. Or no, only if the halacha demands that you cover the hair, then is the status of erva. But today, in the late 20th century in America, when no Goyish women cover their hair, so then Rav Moshe writes, it's obvious that there's no din of erva by a non-Jewish woman, married woman who doesn't cover her hair. And you can bench, and you can make a bracha with the cleaning lady in front of you with the hair uncovered. What does that prove? That proves the whole point. That the hair is unique. It's only the obligation to cover which generates the Shem erva. It's backwards from everything else. So here's what I want to be, say, faket from Rav Moshe. If it's the obligation to cover which generates the status of erva, then what's the difference if it's arousing, not arousing? It's an irrelevancy. It's the obligation to cover which causes the status of erva, not the fact that it's arousing. It's not arousing, because the 16-year-old single girl, the 20-year-old single girl is going around that way. It's the obligation to cover which makes it an erva. So in my opinion, one could argue against the opposite. That even if you'll tell me that when it comes to the arms or the part of the leg or whatever, that the halacha is that it is not considered tefach bish erva in a place where everybody goes with it uncovered. When it comes to the hair, it won't help. Even if everyone goes away, the halacha determines it to be an erva. Exactly the reverse of what Moshe writes in his shuvah. As a suggestion, I'm not saying it definitively, it's a suggestion. This is relevant for many areas. I'll give another example.
Yes, you're over shulchan tov.
Of course. I'll give another example. Let's say relatives. Let's say a mother or daughter, closest relatives, a mother or daughter. So the Pesukim say, based on the Gemara, There's no din of erev by a mother and a daughter, that these restrictions don't apply, the restrictions against physical contact don't apply, all these things, they don't apply because Kodesh Baruch built into nature, there's no Yetzirah for mother or daughter, no problem, fine. So what about if the mother is not dressed properly, the daughter in your own house, what's the din? So the way I'm saying now will become somewhat of a radical point. If she's not dressed properly, let's say she's single, she's going in a night clothing or something, which it may not be a problem because there's no Yetzirah, there's no immediate having time element from here, as the Derech Hamuda says, there's no here over here. But if she's a married woman and the head's not covered, could be going to be Usher anyway. Because there the obligation to cover it establishes the Shem Erva and not the hero factor, and therefore there's no exceptions.
But in the private house, there's no dinner.
That's not so. The Mishnah Berurah says that if a man and wife are living by themselves.
No, I'm talking that there is no man. I'm talking with the dinner.
Between women, no problem. The whole Shem. A woman can bench when the other woman, I'm talking about there's a man and a woman. But if a man and a woman are married, they're married for happily for 50 years, and they're living by themselves in the house, there's no one else is there. There's no one who has to cover anything. But if he wants the bench, so then she has to put on a head covering. That's a din. But so there's some saying, it might apply even to a case where there's no hero because of this concept of objective. So here I want to go with the objective. I was the one who was arguing against objective the whole time. Now when it comes to the obligation to cover the hair, there I want to say it's objective. So that's what I wanted to suggest, backwards, au contraire. The opposite of what the Ramosha has in his tshuva. It's just a suggestion. I'm not giving any psukim over here. It's a suggestion. Yeah?
But the hair, there's no shame error, what you're saying, right?
There is a shame error. The shame error is generated by the obligation which the Torah imposes to cover it. That's what I wanted to say. Now, I want to discuss something which is was asked before.
One point, I don't know if you touched on. You were talking about a way a woman dresses. What happens, what is the pain situation concerned? When a woman puts on pants?
All right, remind me, I'm still about to answer your question. Well, pants, there's the two issues involved. One issue is that a violation of what we call beged ish. The Torah said that a woman may not wear men's clothing. So many authorities maintain that this man is there in our times, that is no longer a violation of beged ish because they're making pants for the hundreds of millions in America. I mean, without it, hundreds of millions of pair of pants are being worn by women all over the country and all over the world. But there's still a matter of what we call tznius. And it's again fitting it into my scheme of things, I can explain it to you very easily. Maybe I'm still old-fashioned, but I still view it as somehow as a piercing. To my mind, it's still, I can't get used to it. Where I came from, when I grew up, the women did not wear pants. They didn't.
Nobody wore.
Okay. So wait a sec. If there are communities where all the women go around in pants, so again, I can't say it's an absolute prohibition in that community. I can't because things can change. And as a matter of fact, Avadi Yosef has a famous shul about this. The Rishon Lezion Eretz Yisrael, he had a question to the, an answer, response to the public school system in Israel, where they had two choices. They said, Rebbe, we have two choices. Either they wear pants or they wear miniskirts. Because in the heyday of miniskirts, 15, 20 years ago, whatever it was. So he writes back, better they should wear long pants than miniskirts. Hara b'miuto, the lesser of the two evils. That's how he phrased it. Because pants, this cover, right? Especially if they're not tight pants, if they're loose pants, that's certainly much better for the perspective of sneers than the miniskirt, which covers nothing. As far as Begadish, it's not Begadish because they're made for women, it's women all the time. So I agree with him, it's the lesser of the two evils. But to me, it's still a somewhat of an evil. Maybe in 50 years they'll laugh at me and say, well, this crazy rabbi, the sugar that everyone wears pants, who knows? Maybe I don't know what's going to happen in 50 years, I can't predict. But everyone has to look for himself. That's why I'm coming from, it's still a problem. And, you know, I can't predict the future. I don't know. I can't, very far from being able to predict the future. I don't know what it's going to bring. But from where I'm coming, it still bothers me. And I consider it to be not improper. But again, in a certain community, if everyone's going that way and it's accepted, so I can't pass them for that. I'm only trying to speak from my own perspective. So I hope that answers your question. But I never answered your question. You asked a very powerful question. That's the most toughest question of the night.
Let me add on that if I can.
Sure.
Is it better to cover your hair and wear pants, or not cover your hair and wear a skirt?
What kind of question is that? I'm not going to answer that question. I'll tell you why. Let me tell you why I'm not going to answer the question. Someone will say, I'll give you the two violations of the Torah. You're not to steal, you're not to eat non-kosher food. Only kosher food, or is it better to eat non-kosher food, to be honest? I'm not going to answer that kind of a question. I want my measure. It's with the Torah, the Mishnah tells us, Yeah, Torah, Shari, La'achshiv, Schor, and Shom Mitzvah. So who am I to measure if these two things, let's say they both be improper, who am I to measure which is a greater impropriety? I'm not in a position to make such a judgment. So I'm going to stick to the question. Okay, if you don't mind. It's hard enough before you get mixed in other things. Sure, I'll repeat the question. Minus one word. How can it be that so many Orthodox women, even women married to Orthodox rabbis, didn't, or maybe even to this day don't, cover their hair? Okay, that's a very legitimate question. That's a very legitimate question. So the first, the simplest answer to say, there's no dispensation for it whatsoever. It was a terrible thing. We could blame the goyim for it. There's some say that in Russia, way to explain it whatsoever. That's my initial position. Period. That's it. I can't explain it. You went to many of these rabbis whose wives did not cover their hair. I have to get my eyes happened to me. A young couple came to me just before they got married. And they said, well, what's the story with the covering of the hair? So you have to cover the hair. But how come Rabbi X doesn't cover the hair? His wife, Rabbi X doesn't cover the hair? I said, you go to Rabbi X. If Rabbi X gives you a heter, I'm willing to accept it. They went to Rabbi X. Rabbi X said, there's no heter for the woman who's married not to cover the hair. Excuse me, Rabbi X, but I don't want to get personal, but, you know, I can't help but notice the Rebbe's an X. That's a problem. He came back to me in awe. He couldn't believe it. And Rabbi X is a heter for everything. He has a heter for everything. This is coming, he came up empty. So, that's an anecdote. Having said that, I want to offer some kind of defense. And I want to once again re-emphasize that the fact that I offer defense for a particular custom does not...
possible defenses of other circles where they have less stringent rules and regulations. And I may try to explain to you why these customs have a basis in halacha, that they're not violating halacha, even though they may not be up to the standard of a particular community, whether it be here or in Israel or any part of the Jewish globe. But elu ve'elu, that there's a measure of subjectivity built into these rules and regulations, and therefore we can defend the customs which we may have, while at the same time understanding why in another circle different customs becomes mandatory in that particular circle. And at the same time, we should be careful to see that our base is not eroded. That the quote paranoia, which is impels the Rabbanim to, you know, take a certain firm stand on particular activities being out of bounds, beyond limits, is entirely in harmony with traditional rabbinical leadership. And in this sense, I feel that Rabbanim in all times and places have an obligation to lead their people to a life of kedoshim tiyu, to a life of holiness, to a life of purity, so that Jewish men and Jewish women and Jewish marriage can continue to flourish for many generations to come.